Joe's end of The Untouchables.
Adam's end of Untouchable.
Did you know that most movies don't even have one musical motif throughout? Well, this film has several. Hi, I'm Adam Richmond. Welcome to the Movies and Things You Didn't Know About Movies with me, Richmond Adam.
That wasn't a statement of fact. It was just an opinion. You know, you keep humming one of the Ennio Morricone's audio motifs that runs through this. You're cocking your guns and you're gonna lay waste. And I was just merely saying, most movies don't even have one. These cinematic earworms. Untouchable has about five. There's a Ness tune. There's a Connery tune. There's an Untouchable tune. There's a fucking Capone tune. You know, I could go on. Yeah.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to be the host. And Joe prefers to be the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot, You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmondo. This is the show where we chat about the movies or films you forgot that we'd even seen in the first place. Joining me as ever is the old leaky bucket boy, but his bucket is impervious to anything musically incorrect or anything he doesn't like.
I
know you do.
My God, calm down. I know. Hello.
Hello, here he is. Oh. He's called Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello. All right, how's it going?
Yeah, man, I'm piping hot off just having watched the Untouchables.
And I'm piping hot off just having watched School of Rock, so I'm so ready for this.
Is that why you're doing the Jack Black version of Ennio Morricone's? Oh, man.
That could be the case.
Jack Black needs to stop making the sound of a guitar, doesn't he?
No, he absolutely should do it more.
I mean, how could he possibly do it more? That's all he does.
That is true. It's maybe not feasible for him to do it more.
Yeah.
But if he could, I'd say fill her up. Fill her all the way to the top, Jack.
He does exactly the right amount of... that's fine.
I think, yeah, more, yeah. I mean, not what you did, but what when Jack Black does it, it's wow. It's very special. And I don't say this to upset you or to bring you down in any way.
Right.
Of course, today we're going to be talking about Untouchable, The Untouchables. But because I'm hot off the School of Rock press, I think there will be times where I'm forced to compare and contrast the two films. Because when you have two stalwarts like these, it's difficult not to look at them. You know, two giants sizing up against each other. Kevin Costner, Jack Black, Sean Connery, the children of the band of the School of Rock. You know, it's very difficult not to sort of compare them. So that might slip into today's episode, just FYI.
Should we save that kind of fun, comedic bit for the back end of the episode? Because I genuinely would like to talk about...
Got it.
Untouchable.
I'm thinking about new listeners as well. Yeah, I re-listened to an episode of ours the other day. I can't remember which one it was, and I thought, God, this is inaccessible self-indulgence, isn't it? I mean, no one new could possibly feasibly enjoy this at all.
So on today's episode, we're doing 1987's The Untouchables, directed by Brian De Palma, scripted by one of my faves, one of the top playwrights and screenwriters of all time, David Mamet.
Can I just check, will we be calling it Untouchable, or was that a one-off thing we did at the beginning? I like it. I like saying it. Wasn't sure. Again, if we're thinking about new listeners, maybe we won't do that. But what do you think?
In my head, I kept saying it, and I thought, oh, this will be, oh, if I just keep doing this, this will be hilarious.
Right.
And then you said that thing, and I thought, no. The episode's going to start proper. Let's call it The Untouchables.
Yeah.
We'll call it The Untouchables.
Okay, because there is a film called Untouchable as well, isn't there? That French film.
Yeah, and that's a reference to. Because you love that movie, and I've never seen it.
I think that's a good film, yeah. Little sexist, but quite good.
Yeah, that's right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Well, we talked about that. What was the last episode? Knocked Up.
A little bit sexist, but quite liked it.
No, all of that got cut out. Don't worry about it. Okay, cool. We're using the English title, The Untouchables.
Yes.
Yeah? Not the French title. Le Untouchable.
Untouchable. So this, of course, is the made-up story of Elliot Ness, who was a real character. And
a real character, a real person.
Al Capone was also. He was a character and a real person. Al Capone, real person.
Yeah.
It was actually based on a TV series of the same name.
Was it really?
Yeah. The Untouchables.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right.
No one. I just watched some of the extras on the Blu-ray that I watched, popped it on the old Blu-ray. Brian De Palma, the producer, Art Linson, none of them had any affinity or affection for the TV show of the same name. And we're just really looking forward to doing their own thing with it, which is great, which is what you should do when you adapt anything.
Yeah, your own thing.
So here's the Letterboxd. What are you prepared to do? Elliot Ness, an ambitious prohibition agent, is determined to take down Al Capone. In order to achieve this goal, he forms a group given the name The Untouchables. Wow,
yeah.
It is given the name. And it stars, of course, Kevin Costner as Elliot Ness, Sean Connery as his partner Jim Malone.
That's right.
De Niro is Al Capone. You've got Charles Martin Smith is the accountant FBI guy Oscar Wallace. He's really great. And Andy Garcia is George Stone. This film, and very, very rarely for this podcast, this film is exactly the length it should be. It's 119 mins. It's bang on.
Wow.
Maybe shave off a minute. I don't think so.
It's 119.
Nope. It's bang on. Right. Maybe Diving Bell and the Butterfly also gets to have that honour, but it's rare stuff.
Yeah. Can I just pause you for a second?
Yeah.
Yeah? Take a deep breath. I can see that you've come here excited about this film. I feel it. I know that.
Okay.
I'm happy for you.
I'll take a breath. Yeah.
But the speed that you're charging through this at, it's not good for me. It's not good for yourself. Not good for your health, man. Not good for the listener, okay? Take a chill pill. We all know you like the film, okay? Relax. Calm down. Say it again.
Say what again? All of it?
I don't know. Whatever you were saying before. No, not all of it.
Do I go back to the beginning?
I just felt the energy coming off
you. On today's episode,
we
are talking about The Untouchable. Okay. No, so that's fine. We had a little argument on WhatsApp when I found out how you'd watched this movie.
Right. Because I watched it on my phone.
Right.
In three different bouts. One on the train on the way to babysit. One in the bed late at night when the children had gone to sleep. One on my phone. These are all on my phone. The next day when I only had one child to mind and he was sort of looking after himself, you know? So, I really enjoyed it. But that is how I watched it. Now, it was in a sort of... You know, the film's about prohibition, of course. There was a kind of prohibition of a sort in my life over this 24-hour period. And, I was breaking all the rules. I was breaking the rules for you, for the listener. Do you think my wife wanted me to be doing this? No, she didn't want this. But I did it anyway because I thought, fuck her, fuck these kids. I'm going to get this film done for the people that really matter. You know, strangers I've never met before.
And then it seemed like I couldn't watch the movie in time for us to record.
Well,
which is quite rare, you know, because
it's a role reversal for sure. Usually that's my thing.
Yeah. And then I thought, oh, I felt bad. And then as soon as you said how you'd watched it, that bad feeling completely disappeared because, I mean, I feel like you're going to say some nice things about this film.
Yeah.
But do you feel like you've seen them? I feel like if someone says they've watched something on their phone, I feel like they haven't watched it on their phone.
That's crazy.
I'm sorry, I feel like they haven't watched a movie. A woman at work said that she watched a whole movie on TikTok. And I just thought, you haven't watched a movie. That's not the equivalent of...
Well, no. That's certainly not what I did. That's not the same thing at all.
I mean, you've come further down the stream, but you're still in the stream, the disgusting stream of content
consuming. I'm not in the stream.
You're in a stream.
No. Do you want to hear... This is my take on watching films on your phone, by the
way. Please, yeah.
Okay. The most crucial thing is sound, okay? So something I didn't mention was that I was wearing very expensive, very good, over-the-head, over-the-ear headphones the whole time, okay? With some noise cancellation on. There's no outside... I don't want to hear those kids, okay? I only wanted to hear...
Tell me about it.
Kevin Costner, Sean Connery, et al., and Ennio Morricone, of course. We'll come back to him later. So audio-wise, it's better than the cinema experience. And then you think in screen size. Maybe that's a problem. Is it too small? Can I really appreciate the cinema, okay? Hear me out. Perspective, okay? My phone isn't on the other side of the room. It's in front of my eyes. It's like I'm wearing glasses, okay? Like, the thing, relative to my vision, the phone is filling as much of my vision as the cinema screen does. And for most of the film, I'm watching it in the dark, after bedtime. Everyone's asleep, except me. And I'm there, and I'm locked in. So, as far as I'm concerned, my audio and visual experience watching this film on my phone is equal to watching it on the TV at home, okay?
Partly assuaged. I wouldn't say equal, but let's listen. I mean, listen, hey?
Better then.
Okay, yeah. Let's, fine. Fine.
That was a comment. That was a pretty compelling argument. You've got to admit.
Of course, a movie that's streamed, it's not the same. It's not the same quality as it when you're playing it on your Blu-ray. That's just compression, okay? So, I've seen it as I've not even seen it as De Palma-ment on the big screen. Oh, Lord De Palma. You got me on this, hands up, hands held up. I didn't want it, but then at the same time, I really, really wanted it. I'm really glad because the last time I gave this a good old rewatch was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I hadn't thought about it in a long time, and it was a pleasure to plop back on.
That's quite recent for you, I would say. Usually it's like 10 years since you've seen a film, but this one, 4. I'd say that's like in maybe... How many times have you seen it? Would you say it's been in like somewhat regular rotation?
I've seen... The first time I saw this... I mean, this last time... I'm really bad for starting sentences, stopping, and starting new sentences.
That now because you've edited yourself for a couple of years.
Yeah. So I would have seen this when I was... 14 or so, and then very regularly in the next 5 or 8 years to that, and then once I hit my mid-20s to mid-30s, it's starting to spread out maybe once or twice, and then we're down to once or twice from 35 to 45.
Sorry,
to
I didn't ask how often you have sex with your wife, Adam. I asked how many times have you seen the film Untouchable.
The point is, this movie, you were talking about music last time when we were chatting about Pirates of the Caribbean. I know this film like a song. Like there are moments in this I was doing De Niro's... I know the dialogue so well, but I haven't thought of it, and I'm doing enthusiasms. You got nothing, and it's just this. It's all there, It's in it's in this lovely little teenage dusty locker with a jizzy sock and other stuff. So. But yes, obviously, you just because you know something so well, you don't pop it on anymore. So it's such a lovely thing to have an excuse. So thanks, Joe. Yeah. You're my hero.
A reason to pop it on.
But what about you?
I think I've seen this film twice before. Once as a teenager, where I sort of I don't know. I suppose I'm not certain that I had read that much about it beforehand or knew that much about it beforehand.
So was it not, it wasn't one of those movies that your cousins et al. Were giving you as homework?
It wasn't. And actually that brings me to a slightly different but broader point about the film, which is that I'm slightly confused about this film's position in the canon, because it's not talked about as one of the, you know, top tier films. It's not really talked about as a Robert De Niro performance that, you know, people sort of reel off or list when they're talking about their favourite Robert De Niro films. I know, appreciate he's not in the film that much. That could be part of the reason why. But when I watch it and think, this definitely is iconic. And one thing I will say, I have a leaky bucket. Regular listeners will know that. New listeners should know that a leaky bucket is our inside joke for me forgetting everything constantly about most films. But the scene where the pram, obviously, is going down the stairs and there's the slow motion shootout in the train station at the end of the film, that is ingrained in my brain for some reason. And I don't know why. I'm not certain why, because I don't think I've seen that beyond the film. I don't think I've seen that parodied. I don't think that's on the poster. But there's something strikingly visual about that scene. It's very iconic to me. So I'm a little confused about how this film is regarded. Is it maybe just one or two tiers below the very top?
Well, can I say? I'll keep it to three things. One specifically about the train sequence there. David Mamet refers to it as the cockamamie because it wasn't in his script. And De Palma, he came up with it and he shot it in the moment. Like, it wasn't storyboarded. He came up with it as he was doing it. He knew he wanted to do it. He basically was inspired by classic, some old black and white flick, Battleship Potemkin, which has the baby carriage falling down the stairs. And he was like, oh, I want to do that. It's just pure cinema. So that's my first point. The second, why it's not canon or held up, I think it's because people are fucking snobs. Brian De Palma is generally, like, always been kind of kept out of the conversation. It's always been Spielberg, Scorsese, and Coppola as well. Like, and De Palma was in that set. But De Palma just, I think he was always dismissed as this Hitchcock copyist, and he's just this big, flashy, showy director. And then a film like this, it's very big, it's really violent, and yeah, it's weird that people don't. I think maybe people think that the De Niro performance is maybe a bit of a pantomime thing, but it's great. He's great in it. The movie's great. It's really well cast. It's really simple. I think there's no nuance to it. It's like Mamet talks about it as like a melodrama. It's really good versus evil. There's nothing cool about it, but there's no nuance about it at all. But then it's just really, really watchable. The craft is amazing. And so, yeah, I don't know. De Palma just never got any respect about anything. And then a film like this, I think, just kind of gets considered as, I guess, a big Hollywood flick, and easy to dismiss. But there are no stars in it. I don't think it had a huge budget, and it's certainly not a typical Hollywood movie. Like, it begins with a little kid holding a briefcase exploding. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely brutal, the opening scene.
It's got its heart on its sleeve. And so it needs to be and should be in the canon, as a lot of De Palma stuff needs to be.
I think the most interesting thing you said to me is that it's not that cool. You know, when I think about it up next to films like The Godfather, Goodfellas, these crime classics, the most famous of the genre, what they do have is they at least appear to be slightly more nuanced. I'm not sure that they are, but they appear to be more nuanced insofar as the heroes are anti-heroes, and, you know, it's not really clear like who the audience are backing during the story. But also the other thing is that they're cool. They have a vibe to them. Like, young men watch them and think it would be cool to be gangsters. There's none of that here. As you said, the film opens with a scene of not just of a little girl. You know, she sees that a man has left his suitcase in a pub. She grabs it and she chases him out to give it back to him. The man can hear that the girl is doing that, and he just completely ignores her. He knows she's about to explode. It's a brutal opening to a film. Incidentally, I wish the film had more of this. Like, I think that's such a powerful start, and it becomes a little bit more PG after that point, which I think is kind of a bit of a waste. But there's never a question as to whether Al Capone is a good or a bad guy. There's never a question as to whether Kevin Costner is a good or a bad guy. It is, as you say, good versus evil. It lacks that sort of that again, air quotes, nuance, and therefore it sort of isn't cool, really. Maybe that's what it's missing. Maybe that's why it doesn't feature in those lists. But it's very different to those films, and it's kind of enjoyable in a different way. And it's more interesting, the style in which the film is made. It's kind of hybrid noir, right? It's not really a straight noir film. It's got noir-y elements to it. But it's like, I think it's much more attractive, and I much prefer watching it. It's just not very cool.
I mean, I think the key thing with that, Godfather and Goodfellas, they're the gangsters as well.
Yeah, this film isn't really about Al Capone, right?
Right, and the Godfather's got it's more kind of classy and moody and, I guess, arty.
Look at these tangerines. Look at these Sicilian tangerines.
I've only ever watched the Godfather trilogy once all the way through.
Really?
I don't, you know, it's not really in my wheelhouse of interest. So
sure.
It's time to rewatch it properly.
Should we do it for this podcast? Because I've seen it more than once, but I haven't seen it for a very long time. And I'm dangerously close to being that guy in the pub who says The Godfather is fucking boring.
Right, me too. I mean, yeah. Goodfellas, that was always my movie. I could watch that and have watched it a million times.
I really don't like that one. It's too sleazy for me.
But with Untouchables, there's just something, I think it's the Mamet of it that I love. And I've been reading loads more about Mamet just generally in the last year or so, about how he writes and about story. And I just like his approach. This is what he says. There's no such thing as character other than the habitual action, as Mr. Aristotle told us 2,000 years ago. When he writes a screenplay, anyone sort of, a writer sort of going, what's the character like? Who are they? He says it's all nonsense. You know, you write what the character does and you play what the character does, and that's who they are. And then the viewer watches and goes, oh, this is what they're like.
You know who says that? You know who agrees with that?
Who agrees with that?
Fucking Gandalf, man. You remember what Gandalf says, don't you? Because Frodo says to him, of course,
I wish it need not have happened in my time, says Frodo. I wish the ring had never come to me, Gandalf.
And Gandalf says, so do all who live to see such times. But it is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us, Adam. Of course, another, there you go, fantastic message from Lord of the Rings, agreeing with David Mamet. It's not who you are as a character. It's what your actions are, what your actions say about you. Your actions make a character, don't they? Gandalf knew that. Therefore, Mamet knows it as well.
Yeah, and the other really interesting thing that Woy said is the audience requires not information, but drama. Like, Mamet hates exposition. He doesn't want a scene where two characters are sitting around talking about a third character. Forget it. He doesn't want characters saying things like, as you know, blah, 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 exposition. He's like, forget it. The audience don't want to know that. It's like drama. Someone, the protagonist wants to achieve something in the scene, in the act, in the movie, and he has to overcome it.
You know who else knew that, Adam?
Is it Bilbo Baggins?
It's Aragon, because of course you remember in Two Towers, when it looks like all hope is lost, they're in Helm's Deep, they're in the keep, the keep of Helm's Deep, and Theoden is saying, "What was this all for?" And Aragon says, "Ride out with me, ride out and meet them." Theoden says, "For death and glory?" Aragon says, "For Rohan, for your people." And Gimli says, "The sun is rising." And then, of course, you'll remember that Théoden said, "Yes, yes, the horn of Helm Hammerhand shall sound in the deep one last time." Then that's, of course, when they make that speech. Because, you know, a scene needs something to happen, doesn't it? Théoden knew that. Aragorn knew that. They got to do something in the scene. And therefore, Mamet knows it, doesn't he, Adam? Mamet knows it too.
Because Aragorn and... knows it. And as he says, every scene needs to be dramatic. And what he means by that is that the main character must have a simple, straightforward, pressing need which impels him or her to show up in the scene. This need is why they came. It is what the scene is about. Their attempt to get this need met will lead at the end of the scene to failure. This is how the scene is over. It's this failure will then, of necessity, propel us into the next scene. All of these attempts.
That's right. Sneaky little hobbitses. Wicked, tricksy, and false hobbitses. You know.
Any scene thus which does not both advance the plot and stand alone, that is dramatically by itself, on its own merits, is either superfluous or incorrectly written.
Oh. Gollum. You know, what has it got in its pockets is not its business. You know, that sounded a bit more like Yoda, to be honest. That was so wrong.
We eat it raw and wriggling, Luke Skywalker.
You know?
Ring this is. Having it had it in a cave I have. So long
how precious is this?
Drop it into the dark and a hobbit has got it. How convenient this is.
Yeah, they're quite similar, come to think of it now, aren't they? They're very similar. You know, almost as though if the lava... lake of lava that Gollum fell into had sort of crystallized him into, you know, some kind of stone, and then years later he was chiseled down in a sort of Han Solo type way, turned wise. Basically the same character at that point, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, I tell you what I'm excited about. I can't wait to see Andy Serkis's Gollum trilogy. This movie, The Untouchables, Ennio Morricone, he does the music for this, and there's four or five motifs per. There's one for like Ness, there's one for the team. They keep coming in. It's just rich with tunes, and it's very clear. Like everything else in this movie, is very, very clear. You know where you are by depending what audio motif comes and plays. And there's a particular one that caught your ear that you kept doing at the beginning of the show, right?
There is. There absolutely is. I'm going to play a tiny snippet now. This is actually very near the beginning of the film. This composition is called Al Capone. Now listen to this, and let me know what kind of guy you think Ennio Morricone thinks Al Capone is. Okay, there it is, Adam, right? That is just two things, okay? One, that's absolutely fucking ridiculous.
What?
Okay, it's ridiculous. No, in a great way, in a good way. In a pantomime way. Mm. In a somehow it is both completely wrong for the film and elevates the film at the same time. I don't understand how that works, but it's so funny. I mean, I laughed out loud watching that scene. It's also, number two, it's hands down the sleaziest music I have ever heard in my life. And it's so expressive. Never before have I listened to music and thought, this is music in the shape of a human being, and that human being is Al Capone through the eyes of Ennio Morricone. It's unreal, this music. And it's so weird in the film. It sets such a strange tone. And, of course, it plays over the embarrassing riches of the life of Al Capone, living in this 5-star hotel. This is immediately contrast with the scene that's come just prior, where you see a little girl be exploded outside of a pub. It's absolutely fantastic.
The grandiosity of the music goes with the grandiosity of De Palma's direction. De Palma opens the movie with this top-down shot of Capone laying back having a shave. And then later on in the movie he plops the camera right basically almost at the feet of the heroes and like really shooting them high. He's really expressive, bold, odd angles, and then he'll go in really close, and then he does these lovely tracking shots. There's a scene where they're all Connery, Costner, Garcia, and the other one. They're all sat round. They've had a great success, and the camera, they're smoking cigars, and the camera's panning around as they chat. And you would have, every time the camera passes someone's head for a minute, but that, don't worry, you're not going to miss the dialogue is timed perfectly with when the person then is on screen. The whole thing is just craft and style and tone, and it seems virtuoso.
Something else that happens in this film is there are some scenes that play out almost exclusively in one shot, and an unmoving shot. So, for example, there's a scene where Kevin Costner goes around to Sean Connery's house, and he wants to recruit him to become a police officer on his special team. And Sean Connery's unsure about this. Now, there's a lot of emotion in the scene. Kevin Costner's kind of at his wit's end. He's at the stage in the film where he's realised that his current department aren't going to be able to help him at all, that perhaps the task that he's signed up for is one that is too sizable for him to compete with. And Sean Connery is battling with some kind of history and some sort of drive, he describes in the scene, to stay alive and therefore not put his head above the parapet. But you can see also there's something in him that wants to decide to say yes to this man, which he doesn't do in this scene. That happens later in the film. Now, with all of that emotion there, you would expect, like a standard director, I think, would include many close-ups, or at least many different shots, right? So you can see the actors' faces, you can see Sean Connery's struggle with this decision, or you can see Kevin Costner's desperation to get him to agree. Brian De Palma doesn't do that at all. Brian De Palma shoots the entire scene from the side of the room. You can't really see their faces. You don't know what's happening. It's a bit more like a play than anything else. There's a little bit of like score that makes you feel a little uncertain that rests beneath it as well. And I watched that on my phone and I thought, this is fucking weird, man. Like, what I don't know why it works on me, but it really worked. But it allows you to paint the picture that you want. It doesn't force anything on you. It just says, this is what's happening. It allows the performances to speak for themselves. It allows the shots to, it, like, there's so much space in it as well. And there's so many instances in this film where I watch it and I think, why has he done it? I might not know why he's done it that way, but he's made a choice that a normal film director wouldn't make. And the whole film looks and sounds different because of it. And that's why it's a good movie.
He doesn't cut unless he needs to cut. And there's a real confidence to it. And then he'll really only go in close when he's supposed to. What's so great about that Connery-Costner scene that you just chatted about, when Connery does come around, maybe two scenes later, you're with Costner. He's in the cop shop. He's met the accountant. He's coming out. He's like, oh God, this bloody Poindexter wants to get Capone on numbers. And you're just on Costner. And then you see Costner's demeanor change. He's seen someone. You don't know who he's seen. Of course you know who he's seen. We don't cut, though. We stay on Costner, and Costner walks, and the camera tracks back. It tracks back. We're not cutting yet. Comes back, and it's all one shot, and then he's talking to Connery, and you're behind Connery's shoulder. This Connery's big reveal of, I'm going to join you. It's just good stuff.
It's a movie.
Also, the performances he gets, you don't feel like it's been cut together in the edit room. No. He's got it on the day. And it's all in the can. And I don't know, it's just very, very pleasing. And people don't make movies like this anymore. But then they make them differently, and they pretend it's a style. They pretend it's a choice. And it's like, no, I just don't think you have the chops, mate. Or woman, could be a woman.
Bonjour. Nice sweater.
We've been sort of, you know, we've been laying a yellow brick road to Palmer throughout this episode. And I really don't know that much about him. I know enough that when I saw that he was the director, I went, oh, I know that name. That's all I know. So come on. I want you to be my waiter, and I want you to be bringing over the Brian de Parmesan, and I'm not going to say when, okay? I mean, I will at some point, but... I'm going to start at the first non-short, which is in 1968.
Yeah, this is where I'm not that much of a Palmer fan. But
Murder a la Mod.
No.
Okay, 1968, Greetings.
Yeah, no, I think, not seen, but I think maybe De Niro pops up in that. He worked early on with De Niro, quite interestingly.
Oh, really?
Yes. They go back.
Okay.
It's either that or High Mom or something. Greetings.
Well, here's one. The Wedding Party from 1969, which he was the director as Brian De Palma with no space between D and Palmer. Interesting that he was playing around with that there. Interesting.
Not seen it.
There's Dionysus in 69 in 1970.
Don't know what that is.
There's Hi Mom in 1970.
I'm going to guess again. De Niro's in that one as
Maybe
well.
De Niro's in
Maybe
that
De Niro's
one.
In that
and
one.
Then there's Get to Know Your Rabbit in 1972.
Yeah, this is all I've never dug so far.
I'm just going to keep saying films, and you stop me when you've heard of one, okay?
Mm.
Sisters, Phantom of the Paradise.
No.
Obsession.
No.
Well, you're going to know this one. Carrie.
Yeah, I began with Carrie.
1976. Carrie's a very famous film, isn't it?
Yeah, everyone bangs on about it.
It's the horror one where at the end she's magic and she locks all the doors in the school gym where the party is and she kills everyone.
Yeah.
Right?
And I knew that it was in my cinema magazines and it's like this is the homework, but they'd given it all away back when you had film. Yeah. They were like, oh, this is they've already said it. Like the same with Deliverance. They're like, by the way, he gets raped in this, and you're like, okay, yeah. Great. This is hard to.
By the way, weep, 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 weep.
So you're watching, you're doing the homework, knowing what the end of the thing is. I never rewatched it. So, it's obviously important to people. Mike Flanagan, who is my horror director guy at the minute, he's remaking it as a TV show, I think. You know, he rates it. I like him, so it's obviously a good movie.
Great.
I mean, stylistically, he did interesting, odd stuff with it. You know, this split screen at the end.
Okay. All right. Well, again, I'll carry on. Stop me when you've heard of a film. Yeah? The Fury. Home Movies. Dressed to Kill.
Yes. Now, this is where I really start to enjoy De Palma.
1980.
Yeah. Michael Caine's in this one.
Michael Caine. A mysterious blonde woman kills one of the patients of a psychiatrist and then goes after the high-class hooker who witnessed the murder. I think it's very important when you say the word hooker, because you shouldn't say hooker anymore, you should say sex worker. But I think it's very important when you do say the word that you say hooker, like that.
Yeah, this is when he's in his kind of sleazy Hitchcockian phase, and this is where I like this because they're all sort of sleazy and sexy. And
well, 1981, there is the film Blowout with John Travolta.
That's Tarantino's, one of his all-time favourites.
A movie sound recordist accidentally records the evidence that proves a car accident was actually murder and consequently finds himself in danger.
Yeah, have you seen Blow Up?
Blow Up?
The I forget the name. I think he's an Italian director. It's 60s or 70s flick about a photographer. Really good.
So.
I think you'd like it. You should watch it. And he's taken a photo and then he becomes obsessed that he thinks that he's taken the photo of someone being murdered.
Right.
Also problematic for various other reasons, but very, very good movie. And then Blowout is the audio equivalent. Like De Palma's kind of cherry-picked that notion and then... It's good, yes, good. It's you should watch both. They're really
people have tried to get me to watch Blowout before.
Have they?
Yeah, that's in there. That's in there as the kind of older cousins on the older cousins list.
Do blow up first, and then do blow out. It's hard not to say both of those and just not think of blowy, isn't it?
Yeah, blowy. That's the third one. That's the one where a man accidentally gets a blowy
from a robot.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then in 1983, a little old film that listeners will have heard of, Scarface with Al Pacino, in the 1980s, a determined criminal-minded Cuban immigrant becomes the biggest drug smuggler in Miami and is eventually undone by his own drug addiction. Yeah? This is where, I mean, it's not where, but it's where, you know, the sentiment of don't get high on your own supply guy comes from. Because not your own supply guy, but your own supply, comma, guy comes from. Because, you know, if you do that, you will end up being quite annoying with a stupid accent.
Yeah, but he also don't want to fuck your sister, I'd say, is the message of that movie.
Right, yeah.
That didn't, that, you know, that film didn't do very well on release. I didn't know that either. It's partly why he got into The Untouchables. Wow. Yeah, didn't...
Opening weekend, US and Canada, December 11th, 1983, $4.5 million from a $50 million budget.
That, you see, that's not going to do it.
Its gross worldwide was $66 million, so it probably isn't making money there. I mean, it definitely isn't making money. We know it's definitely not making money.
No, it's
because
not.
Because of how the gross worldwide works.
It's not doing the business, but, of course, it entered culture. Subsequently, a lot through hip hop, but now it's not really thought of again. It's, I think it's fallen out of culture again
through hip hop.
Hip hop, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It was a really big thing on MTV Cribs. A lot of the rappers in the 90s would initially it started to come out, then they would have Scarface, they would reference Scarface being on their DVD shelves. They had DVDs back then, or video, right. I don't know actually if it was the 90s, video. It was more like video. Laser much disc, like maybe
possible early 2000s, most likely VHS. Okay.
Maybe it was more like the 2000s, Laserdisc.
Then it was DVD,
right? And then of course it crops up a lot in kind of late 90s, early 2000s hip hop lyric. The "Don't Get High in Your Own Supply" was I would hear that a fair bit. I listened to that era of hip hop, and then it famously they wanted to re-release Scarface with a hip hop soundtrack, and De Palma said, "Go fuck yourselves." Absolutely not.
Right.
He hated it. He was just notoriously, he hated
hip-hop. He hates hip-hop.
Hated really? It.
Okay. Well, you know what he did like? Well, in 1984, just a year after the Scarface came out, he was, of course, the director for the famous music video for Bruce Springsteen's Dancing in the Dark, which, you know, that's the one that has Courtney Cox doing that famous... the Carlton dance.
Yeah, pulling her on stage.
Da, 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 da. Yeah.
He did the Frankie Goes to Hollywood relax video.
He did.
They pop up in Body Double, which you're about to get onto at any point now. Did you not know that about Scarface and hip hop? I feel like that's like the hackiest thing I've ever said, and I apologize to the listeners.
Maybe I'm too young. I don't know. Maybe that it does what you've said. It could as easily be true as be like one of those things that was like written in the Telegraph, and then you've read it and you've gone, "Did you know that the youths of hip hop enjoy the film Scarface?"
Yeah,
and it's because, you know, an old white journalist was once told that that I don't know, Ice Cube had it and he's put it in a Pimp My Ride episode or something, you know.
No, I mean, I lived through its slow ascent into, like, everyone was suddenly talking. And then I went to uni and I was like, oh,
I thought it was just through the impression, though, wasn't it? What's the thing? What does he say? He says, "Come and get me my, come and meet my friend.
Say hello to my little friend."
Oh, say hello to my little friend. Yeah, I feel like it was just people doing that that made it into something. Wasn't it? Because it's, I mean, it's sort of like, it's a ridiculous film, isn't it? Do you not agree? It's sort of, And I don't mean that in necessarily a negative way.
It's a ridiculous film. It's an ugly film. And it's one of those movies where the hero, the anti-hero, he's so horrible. But it's possibly supposed to be a satire of him. But everyone then just starts to celebrate him as this guy to aspire to. The world is yours. That's what he, you know, Tony Montana looks up into the sky. And it's supposed to be ironic, you know, that it's on this blimp. You love blimps. Yeah, it's one of those blimps. Sure.
Big fan of blimps. Airship.
That's definitely name checked quite a lot in hip hop.
Right.
But that was also the best the good times for hip hop when it was good. You know, it wasn't all like it wasn't it. Shit, you know. NWA, Ice Cube, Public Enemy.
I think Ice Cube was in NWA.
Yeah, no, he was originally, but then he went out by himself. Right. You're allowed to say, I prefer his solo stuff to.
Really?
Yeah.
What's your favourite solo Ice Cube song? Below Zero, you like that one?
No.
Mr. Frosty? Do you like No Woman, No Tundra?
No, are you making like Ice Cube puns or something?
Yeah.
Okay, no, but genuinely.
Clink in the drink? Drink in the clink?
No.
That's that sound the ice makes on the glass.
Check Yourself. That was always my favourite.
Check Yourself.
Check Yourself. The album the album that was from, I believe, what was it called? The Predator. I love The Predator because that had vocal samples from the movie Predator.
Right, so you like that. You like it whenever there's movies in a song.
Yeah, that was the one I had on loads when I was 13 or 14, The Predator.
Yeah.
Check Yourself, Now We've Got a Wet Ya, Fuck 'Em.
Yeah.
Gangster's Fairy Tale 2.
Yeah, all the classics. You better check yourself or you wreck yourself, because I'm bad for your health. I come real stealth, dropping bombs on your moms, kill car alarms. I mean, beyond that, he just did a bunch of other movies.
You know? No, he didn't, because this is where he was.
No, he didn't.
Really getting into it. Yeah. He's really hitting his stride now.
Here we go. Wise Guys, okay? Into the Untouchables in 1987.
So he did Untouchables to show that he could do a hit.
Untouchables 2? I haven't seen that one. Is it any good?
He did the Untouchables as well. He did it because he wanted to do a flick that would make money so then he could make films that he wanted to make.
Right.
It slingshots him into his next period.
Gotcha.
Right.
Well, I mean, his next period is Casualties of War.
Ugh.
In 1989.
No, thank you.
The Bonfire of the Vanities in 1990.
Famous debacle.
Famous debacle?
Yeah, based on the book of the same name. Famous debacle.
What, the book was called Famous debacle?
No. It's called Bonfire of the Vanities by Thomas Wolfe.
After his mistress runs over a young teen, a Wall Street hotshot sees his life unravel in the spotlight and attracts the interest of a down-and-out reporter, starring Tom Hanks, Bruce Willis, and Melanie Griffith.
Yeah, no, never seen it. Read half the book. Can say no more it was a renowned debacle. And I love to say debacle.
Tell me if this was a debacle. 1992's Raising Cain with John Lithgow. The oncologist wife of a prominent child psychologist suspects her husband has an unhealthy scientific obsession with their child, unaware of what or who is really going on inside his head.
Such a fun, underrated flick. This is De Palma returning to his Hitchcockian roots. John Lithgow is so good. He's the best he's ever been in this. It's really silly. It's really well done. It's just good. It's almost bordering on camp, but it's also not. I think it's a must-see for anyone who's interested in De Palma's work.
Wow.
I guess, again, that's why he never got accepted, because there's also something quite laughable about it. It's very 90s. You got to watch it with, you know, your tongue in your cheek, you know, with a little pinch of salt.
You've got to put salt in your mouth as well as put your tongue in your cheek.
Yeah. Like, for example, you've got to watch Untouchables and you've got to accept at some point, for some reason, he decides he's going to go POV, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't established that at all as a thing. And it's just,
he hasn't.
And he's just going to do it. And he's going to go.
He's going to do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm just doing POV now.
And then he's going to go, what do you think of that?
Yeah. This is my sequence. Say, I don't know.
Confused.
I don't know. I think it works. And it's the same.
Sure.
So I think Raising Cain works.
Okay. What about this one? 1993's Carlito's Way. A Puerto Rican former convict, just released from prison, pledges to stay away from drugs and violence, despite the pressure around him, and lead onto a better life outside of NYC, starring Al Pacino, Sean Penn, and Penelope Ann Miller.
So tired. So tired. Eddie Barzum.
This is Sean Penn's finest performance, and this is the flick that Scarface could have been. It's too long. I used to watch it quite a lot in my teens. I'm very fond of it, but John Leguizamo pops up in a quite Benny Blanco from the Bronx in a fairly iconic role. I think people are familiar. Vigo is in this. He's really good.
Really
Hello. Good early performance from Vigo. Have you never seen
Tickle
it?
Tickle me interested. No, never seen it. Never
Why?
Seen it.
Why? Al Pacino.
I got it on DVD. You know, I've been doing this thing because I moved house recently. I had many years ago when my father died, I received some money, a little bit of life insurance money from him. He didn't have any money, but he had life insurance and he died very young. So I got some money as a young man, and I spent it all on DVDs and alcohol. It was a great time. So I got many, many DVDs. And so about, I would say, 17, 16 years ago, I put all of my DVDs in two massive black DVD cases, sleeves, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them. And ever since then, I've, you know, less often, but still I've bought DVDs, lots of Blu-rays, lots of sort of, you know, special TV series, anthologies, whatever, that I kept in the boxes instead of putting them in these sleeves. But I've just moved into a smaller home than the one I lived in before, and I've got to downsize, Adam. So what did I do? I bought a third sleeve, and I promised my wife that I would start to move these DVDs into the sleeves and get rid of the boxes.
Why didn't you give them to me? Can I have them?
Well, no, I mean, I want to keep the discs.
Well, can I just give them to me, please? Can I have them?
No.
I'm fully erect at the minute, and I'm on the verge of coming, and then, but you're losing it. You're losing me by saying you've de-boxed and re-sleeved.
Yeah, yeah. And in some cases I've opened the plastic on DVDs that I'd never actually watched that I bought years and years and years ago.
Can you video that and WhatsApp me videos? Could you just WhatsApp me you opening the opening the plastic, mate? Oh, my days. Yeah,
that's right. One of which was Carlito's Way. So, no, I have never seen it.
I'm just very jealous of all these Blu-rays you're getting to unbox.
So many. All the Bournes. Oh,
Reborns. So, sorry, how did we get onto this?
Oh, because Carlito's Way is one of the films I unsheathed. I still haven't watched it.
Yeah.
I'll watch it.
Okay. I don't think you'll like it, but...
I won't watch it. I haven't watched it for 20 years, so I'm probably not going to do it now.
I think it's worth... No, do you know what? It's not probably worth watching.
I'm not going to. I am going to move on to 1996, though, which is where the list ends, because you've been waiting for me to get here since I started talking about Brian De Palma. It's your favourite film, Mission... Impossible.
Yeah, it's the best Mission Impossible. De Palma lays it out. It's all here. It's so good. It's so well done. It's where it's not an action movie. It's a spy thriller. You know, it's what I love. There's so many fun directing choices. It's this kind of interesting director who does lots of fun stuff, and he's doing it on the blockbuster stage.
Mm.
There's a real imprint on that that. I think Cruise did actually want, he wanted to, his vision for the series was like, oh yeah, let's get a really great director and let's have them put their imprint on each mission. Hello? Hello?
Hi, is that Brian De Palma?
Yeah, let me just put you through. Beep boop, beep boop.
Thank you.
Hello? 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 Hello?
Hello? Hello, is that
hello,
Mr. De Palma?
Hello, yes, this is Brian De Palma speaking. Hello.
Oh, hi there. This is Peter Bradshaw of The Guardian. I'm calling for our prearranged interview.
Hello, Peter. Lovely to speak to you. You're a fan of my work, are you, Peter?
Very much so. Very much so. Most of the oeuvre. Big fan.
What's your favourite of my oeuvre, Mr. Bradshaw?
What's my favourite of the oeuvre?
Mm.
Well, I mean, I'm a huge The Boss fan. So the music video that you did for Dancing in the Dark, I like that. I like Friends as well. Mm. So it was nice to see Monica be able to do a bit of dancing away from Ross, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. So yeah. we're talking about my new movie, are we today?
Whoa, I mean, do you have a new movie? Do you?
I thought you were talking about my new movie, Mission Impossible.
Oh, Mission Impossible. No, yeah. That's the new one.
I was looking at my diary and it was June 1996 and I thought I was here to promote. Yeah. Am I not here to promote the new movie? Am I here to do a retrospective?
Right. That's absolutely right. It's the new film. So, of course, the franchise films haven't released yet, have they? Well, there wouldn't be anything to compare this one to.
No, this is the first of the only. When I spoke to Timothy Cruise about stepping aboard Mission Impossible, he'd seen The Untouchables, my movie The Untouchables, based on the TV series of the same name.
That's a great movie.
He said to me he saw that. Who's the guy who knows how to turn a TV series into a movie? Mr. Brian De Palma. He calls me up. Like, you're calling me up and I say, yes, I've done this before. And so I say, yes, I'll do this again. One and done.
It's always so simple, isn't it, in Hollywood? It's, you know, you always think there's going to be a deeper romance to these stories, but...
Well, he just said the word Hitchcockian to me. He said he wanted it to be Hitchcockian. Right. And I said,
yeah.
Don't mind if I do, Mr. Cruise.
Right, yeah.
That was it.
Well, I wonder if I could... I mean, like, listen, of course I love the film, of course. Of course I did, of course. But I wondered if I could ask you a couple of questions about it, about your creative decision-making involved. Because interesting, what interested me most, of course, was that the film's called Mission Impossible, that you have a true action hero star, don't you, in Tom Cruise. It's clear for everyone to see that he's a real action hero and that, you know, the audience want to see him fighting and striking and running and jumping and doing all the sort of things that an action hero would do. And yet, you've made quite a small little film, haven't you? You've made something that's a bit more restrained, isn't it, than what people might want to see.
I don't know what decade you're calling from, Mr. Bradshaw, but here in 1996, Timothy Cruise isn't really regarded as an action star. I think he's more sure he's been in your Top Guns and your Days of Thunders, but
I'd say he's an action star.
I don't really think they're action movies. More they're flight. They're plane. That's a plane movie. That's a plane movie, Mr. Bradshaw, and a car movie. I consider an action movie. Runny, 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 runny. Explosions, explosions, explosions. Fight. And I have those elements within this movie. But within, deeper, embedded in this movie, is machinations, spy things. Who did what?
Who's Mr.
Thingy? Where's the MacGuffin? Let's keep going.
Okay. The thing is, De Palma, one of the reasons I'm The Guardian's lead film criticism writer is because of my prescience. And I can see that Tom Cruise is clearly a future action star in the making. I just wonder why you made a film where you wanted him to do so little by the way of action, and why you wanted to make something that promised one thing but delivered another altogether. Because, you know, whilst I loved the film and I enjoyed it as an art critic, I know that many audience members have been saying, why is this so boring and weird?
Well, I think Mr. Bradshaw, the box office of the time, and I don't know because I'm not living in the future, but I believe that the box office of this movie, as it will play out, will show that people do want this, and they did see it, and they do want to see it, and they did like it. And in fact, they will like it so much that they will say to Mr. Timothy Cruise, can we have some more of this, please? And he'll say yes.
And they'll say, can it be a bit more action-y, though?
And then they'll get that, and then they won't like it. They will go, what happened to the spy stuff? introduced by Mr. De Palma, me, you know, the who's going where, what's doing what. Where's mother? Mother's over there. Who's got the list? Oh, the list is over somewhere else. Oh, I've got a mask on. You know, have some chewing gum. Red light, green light. These are things that will sustain in a future series. I've seeded it. And I just don't think you think it's not all Fury Road. Whatever that is, I don't know, that doesn't come out yet, but it's not all Fury Road, film, is it? It's not all Fury Road.
I don't know what you mean. What do you mean?
The proof is in the pudding.
What's the pudding?
It's not all the Two Towers, okay? Right. It's not the Battle of Five Armies.
That's not out either. That's not
it's
out.
Not all Speak Truth and Enter. It's not all Speak Truth and Enter, God. Mr. Bradshaw.
Are you talking about the novel Lord of the Rings?
Yes, and I know that's why you've been trying to needle me around, okay?
Right. Okay.
I'm not interested in these big, broad spectacles. I'm not talking about Gandalf's glasses.
My God.
I am talking about real people doing real things. Okay?
Right.
Not interested in small people, forced perspective, in big houses.
Adventures. No. Listen, right? If I'm not allowed to talk about the future of this movie franchise, then you're not allowed to talk about films that haven't been released yet. Okay, I'm gonna be straight with you. Brian De Palma, okay. I'm gonna be straight with you. Okay, I'm gonna be straight with you. I'm Peter Bradshaw. I'm gonna be straight with you. Okay.
Yeah.
Your movie's fucking boring. It's fucking boring. It's weird. It's shit. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I think there's something in here. I think you've got it completely wrong, okay? I think it's completely wrong. And to be honest with you, I think you haven't struck it since Untouchables. And that was 9 years ago, okay? Because that's my headline.
Wait!
I always liked doing so. Somehow, it feels like going down a hill.
Should we play the box office game?
Oh, I'd love to play the box office game. For Les Intouchables.
Oh, Intouchables.
Okay. Budget, please. Brackets estimated for this film. What is it that they're spending on this in the mid-1980s?
I've got a lovely story about the budget of this this flick. I don't know the budget of it, but what I do know...
Okay.
Do you know who originally was lined up to play Al Capone?
No, who?
Not Bob De Niro.
Right. Well, that, I mean, I had assumed that because if it was him and then he did play Al Capone, that would be a very boring story.
Yeah, no, you're right. I've really fucked up that.
Let me do it back to you. Hold on. Do you know who was originally lined up to play the Ennis character?
No, who's Ennis?
Oh, what's his name?
Elliot Ness.
Elliot Ness, yeah. Ennis.
Ennis. I like Ennis.
Yeah, Ennis.
No, it was always Costner.
Yeah, it was Kevin Costner. Yeah.
Oh, although actually, they did ask Mel Gibson.
Did they?
Yes.
Oh, my God. All right, so tell me now who was lined up to play Al Capone, and then I'll imagine the film with Mel Gibson and that person.
Gibson couldn't do it because he had another flick. And Costner... He wasn't a star at this time, and De Palma wasn't so keen on him, but Costner had worked with Lawrence Kasdan on Silverado. He'd worked with Spielberg, I think, on a TV show, and everyone said to him, to De Palma, this guy's got the goods. And so Costner gets it. And the studio kept saying to De Palma, you don't need a star, you don't need a star. And so De Palma's like, okay, Costner, fine. He wants Connery, though, so he gets Connery. Yeah. With Capone, British actor. Guess he's a British actor.
Michael Caine?
No, not Michael Caine. Think he's Capone-like. Think, what's that guy who was in Adolescence?
Stephen Graham?
Yeah, no. So who's Stephen Graham back in the late 80s?
Michael Caine?
Bob Hoskins.
Oh, yeah, I guess I would never have thought of Bob Hoskins, but I can totally see how he could play Al Capone. He'd make a fantastic Al Capone.
And so De Palma's like, yeah, he actually says on the, he says, oh yeah, Bob Hoskins, he really rates him, and he says he can do a really good American accent. And I was like, what? No, he can't. But apparently De Palma thought he could. But De Palma, he'd worked with De Niro, it's the tale of two Bobs, and he's pushing for Bob De Niro. He talks him round, and then Bob De Niro, not Hoskins, De Niro gives his figure for his fee for like 2 weeks' work, and it's very, very punchy. And the studio were like, fuck that, no way, we've got Hoskins, we don't need you. And De Palma, he goes to the studio, he says, not only am I not going to make this movie for less money, I'm not going to make it at all if De Niro's not Capone. He says, forget it. So he gets more money. He's like, I need Capone. You do need someone. Because De Niro, he's kind of gangster. He's already got the gangster heft. It's almost a cameo. He gives it real size.
It's interesting that, because I was going to say, I think the thing I like least about the film is Robert De Niro as Al Capone. For two reasons. One, not his fault. That it just feels kind of, feels very cut and dry relative to what my expectation of a film like this. It goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about good and evil and how clear cut it is. He's just extremely unlikable, and he's also not in the film that much. The other is that maybe it's my expectations because it's Robert De Niro. I expect something more from him, his performance in this film. He doesn't have that much to work with, but I don't really care that much about the scene. Like, one of my least favourite scenes is the one where he walks around the table and then hits the guy in the back of the head with a baseball bat. I just sort of, you know, I don't really think that much of it. Is that sad? Is that insane?
No, I get what you're saying. I think actually it's a performance that it seems really broad, but if you watch it on the big screen, as it's supposed to be seen, there's lots of nuance going on. And also, I'm going to say, I'm going to talk more about De Palma. De Palma talks about directing Bob De Niro. And he said he'd worked with him lots before, but when he was directing him on The Untouchables, he said that because the director, that they look at the performance on the monitor, and he's like, there's stuff that Bob's doing that you just can't see on the monitor. And the monitor's tiny. The monitor's almost like the size of a phone. And this is De Palma. He's like, he's talking to you. He's like, this before, he's like, I can't see it. And it's only when he's editing it on you know, big, that he can see, like, De Niro's given him. And I'm not lying, he did.
What just ties do you think I'm doing? Do you think I'm putting my phone on the other side of the room and then sitting back in the chair and squinting at it from 2 meters away? I'm holding it in front of my face, man. It's to my eyes. It is as big as your little TV is across the room from you, okay? This is madness.
Yeah, but I thought that was a fun, good possible link, but because De Palma does say that about the nuances of De Niro's performance. Like, there's this lovely bit at the end where it's this big grand, Costner kind of goes over and he's like, he's trying to say the final line. He's like, oh, you never give up the fight. You never give up the fight until the fighting's done or whatever. And it's so nicely done. De Niro's Capone is like, he can't hear him. You know, and he's like, I don't even know what you're saying, mate. Whatever. I can't even hear you. And like in another movie, you'd have the baddie would have heard it. It would have landed. But De Niro plays it. It plays it quite nicely. So anyway, budget. I'm going to say budget. I don't know what they made for movies in the late 80s. $50 million.
$25 million.
Oh, Well, look at it. It's all on screen. Adjust for inflation.
It's all on, but you've got to watch it on a big screen. Otherwise, you can't see every single cent, can you?
You can't. You can't. That's amazing. Can. Yeah. 25. Okay.
Brian De Palma. Hey, he's got, he's magic, isn't he? You know, that's... fucking Dalai De Palma. Hey. Yeah, you like that?
Yeah, yeah. Don't mind it.
Opening weekend, US and Canada, June 7th, 1987. Now, what does a little movie like this take bums on seats-wise in the 80s? Of course, you'll remember. We haven't even talked about Prohibition, have we? We haven't mentioned alcohol once, which is kind of funny, because one of the best things about this film is how it manages to make a compelling and exciting crime drama out of such a stupid time in history, and also whilst kind of making light of it, you know? You sort of follow, you follow along with the character, don't you? You have Kevin Costner saying at the beginning, "It's a time of prohibition. America has a, has made illegal drinking for this short period of time." And he walks into the police officer's office and he says to them all, "You're on my team now, boys. I don't care what you've done before, but here we don't drink now. If I catch any of you drinking, you'll be slung in the lake before noon's out," that sort of thing. But it's almost as though Kevin Costner has turned to the camera and is looking directly at you and saying, "I know it was stupid, but just remember, it's not really about the alcohol. It's about the fact that Al Capone is a fucking total douchebag and he's really upsetting people and killing them, you know? Remember that girl? It wasn't about the booze. It was about the murders." And then the whole film proceeds to, you know, not really about be about booze at all. And have this, you know, as you said, good versus evil, these almost pious characters that Kevin Costner is the leader of. And at the end of the film,
"Hey, Mr. Ness, did you hear? They're going to repeal Prohibition. What are you going to do?"
"Hey, boy, I think I'm going to have myself a wee drink," you know? It's a sort of a subtle nod to the notion that the Prohibition period of American history is one of the more bizarre.
Well, David Mamet had a, you know, the scrawl, the text at the end of a movie, whatever that's called. There was something a little bit more biting and scathing in the original screenplay that... Didn't make it to screen.
Brian De Palma just cut, huh?
Yeah, Brian De Palma said the American audiences don't want to see that. I like that. I like the idea is like it's irrelevant, you know?
Yeah, it's good. It is irrelevant.
Yeah, Elliot Ness is just like, listen, all I care about is the law. And law has said this is illegal. So guess what? Yeah. You're fucked and I'm going to come and get you.
Those are the stakes of the film. And by the way, Al Capone, if it wasn't like, if alcohol wasn't illegal, he 100% would be murdering people for something else, right? Like, it's just about the money. It's not about the booze. I think it's a really clever way of just almost directly telling an audience, hey, buy in now or fuck off. That's it. You know, I like it.
Yeah, my favorite bit of the movie is when Elliot Ness comes home and he's stuck one in to Capone's operation, and there's a baddie outside his house and he's like, he's the main baddie. He's like, "Oh, I like you like family. Ooh, and the family's nice." And Ness is like, "Oh God!" And he runs into his house and his wife's there. Second thing I love about the movie is how doting the wife is. Patricia Clarkson is, she's a fantastic actress. And this movie never makes the mistake of having the nagging wife. I fucking adore this movie for not having the nagging wife going, "No, what are you doing? Trying to beat Al Capone." She's just totally supportive. And that's my second favorite. And then my favorite bit of the movie is when Ness is then running up the stairs because he thinks something's happened. "Where's the kid? Where's the kid?" And he runs up into the bedroom and he just looks at the bed. It's a tiny room. He's looking at the bed. He's got no, what's it called? No span of vision.
Peripheral vision.
No peripheral vision. Oh, the kid's not there. And then suddenly he has to turn his head. He has to turn his head in this tiny room. And the child is sat by the window playing a game. It's like, oh, the child's not dead. It's the fucking dumbest fake out ever. And he kind of runs over to the child, this lovely, cute little blonde kid. He's like, "What? Why?" He says, "Why are you up?" And she says, this little girl, it's very important that she's a little girl. She says, "I had to finish my ironing." Yes, this movie is coded to be like, if you're a woman, even if you're a little girl,
Don't be asleep, little girl. Be ironing.
Be ironing. And she knows it. She's a child and she knows. I've got to do my ironing.
That's right. I mean, the next scene's when, of course, Kevin Costner rescues the family and takes them off to the safe house. He leaves and the camera goes with him. But if the camera stayed at the safe house, you'd find that the mother and child had just continued ironing in a different location. Because it was the 19... whenever it was. Here's some fun trivia. Do you want some trivia?
Okay, yeah. In between me guessing how much he opened on the box office on the weekend. Yeah.
Do you know the scene where the envelope is dropped on his desk when they try and bribe him?
Saw it. Costner, I spotted this goof.
No, this isn't the goof. This is trivia about that. I know what you're going to say, but that's not what I'm about to tell you.
Costner throws it at him. It disappears. Yeah. And then moments later, he picks it up and pops it in his coat.
It is pretty stupid, that bit. Yeah. Hard to miss. But no, what I was going to say is that in the film version, you never see how much he's offered, right? Mm. But in real life, Al Capone apparently promised Elliot Ness that two $1,000 bills, which at the time was about $47,000, would have been in today's money, about $47,000, would be on his desk every Monday morning if he turned a blind eye to what was happening, which is a huge amount of money. Obviously, he refused the bribe. And in later years, he struggled with money and died almost broke at the age of 54, Elliot Ness. Can you imagine being given 50 grand a week? Like a Premier League footballer, just to ignore Al Capone's misdeeds. Pretty cool, huh?
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
I think this movie cost 25, and I think it made 8 million.
It made 10 million.
Oh, okay, yes, yeah.
Sorry, you said no. Well, what were you about to increase it to?
Brilliant, I was going to go down.
You were going down?
No, I shouldn't have bottled it.
Shouldn't have bottled it. Well, that's exactly what they said to all of the criminals during Prohibition. Because, of course, as you know, drinking wasn't illegal. But bottling and distributing, that was not a legal thing to do. Now, gross worldwide.
Late 80s, 25. This does 80s, this does yeah. the business. It does maybe it makes like 80 mil.
Well, 76 mil, okay, very impressive. Yes. It does make 80 mil. Now, what I will say here is that the gross US and Canada is 76,270,454. The gross worldwide is £76,272,360. So, according to the box office figures here, outside of the US and Canada, the movie made $2,000, which I'm sure is not true. So, I think it's a little incomplete.
Yeah, they probably just haven't. They didn't tally back then.
Well, there you go. But still, pretty close, pretty tight, you know?
Pretty tight.
Good
Thanks.
Job. Yes, yeah, you're inside the 10%. It. Yeah. You were inside the 10% on both the second answers, but of course you weren't anywhere near on the first. So not a true tenner, but still pretty good. 2 out of 3, you know. What are you going to do?
Enthusiasms.
A man has his enthusiasms.
Mine? Gets in the box office board game over this world.
A great Simpsons parody.
TV.
Yeah, TV. But Mr. Burns does a great little... So...
Do you know what? Can I give you a controversial opinion?
Yeah, as long as it doesn't include School of Rock.
Doesn't include School of Rock. Oh, I didn't talk about School of Rock at all. Okay, what I was going to do was make a glib comment about The Simpsons. I won't do that. I'll save that for another time. And instead, I'll quickly just say, because I did promise at the beginning that I was going to talk about School of Rock a little bit, I'll quickly just say the reason I was watching School of Rock with my wife this evening is because last night we only had 45 minutes before the eldest had to go to bed, and we were trying to pick something to watch together, flicking through the TV there, and we were, hey, School of Rock, why don't we pop School of Rock on? Everyone's happy. It's a film that satisfies the whole family, particularly those family members that love, like, when Jack Black goes, love that.
But they've seen it. You know, they've seen it.
They've seen it. They've seen it before. Okay. They're in charge of the control, you know. They're 12 years old, about to turn 13. They're happy with this. And they're popping it on, hanging out with the cool uncle and aunt. And they pop it on. I'm watching it, having a great time. My wife's watching it, having a great time. The eldest watching it, having a great time. We stop at 45 minutes. They go to bed. Everything's smooth given. In fact, I'm very proud of my wife. She said, let's stop it now. And the eldest said, but it's not been 45 minutes yet. And she said, no, but the film wants us to stop it now. And it did, Adam. It did want us to stop it at that point. It was a neat little moment where...
What she meant to say was, this is the midpoint.
No, it wasn't the midpoint. It was just a real transition between not just scenes, but kind of moments, you know, movements. It was a transition between movements. Anyway, this is a long story. I was going to say boring, but actually I think it's great. It's just a long story. What I want to say is two things. One, School of Rock is a great film, okay? It's actually a great film. I will fight anyone that says it isn't. It's a great film. Two, I got to tell my nephew, this the eldest, this kid, 12 years old, who's seen this film and likes this film, I got to say to him, hey, by the way, the director of this film directed some of my favourite indie movies that you haven't seen yet, but later you'll watch them. And then you'll reflect in 20 years' time back and you'll go, wow, that guy made School of Rock in the middle of some of these fucking incredible films. How many directors can claim to have both made films that make real cinema lovers go weak at the knees and also make a film like that which makes every member of a family and the fucking movie studio that happy? Like, that is, just to do those two things is so outstanding that it kind of belies any possible praise that I could give it.
Sorry, are you talking about Brian De Palma?
Oh my god.
Do 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 do.
No, 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 wait.
Oh.
I know you wanted to end on that, but you've got to get me on a movie.
Joe, should we do the bit in the podcast where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot with a view to catching the other one out on a movie they forgot to pick our next movie podcast show we're going to do?
As long as it's with a view, I'll happily do it.
It's always with a view. Hot diggity damn. Okay, I feel like it's going to be the same old crapola, but A Prophet. The French prison flick, A Prophet.
Never seen it.
Listener Stephen Watkinson had also...
Never seen it.
...pitched that. It's a phenomenal movie.
I thought you were saying listener Stephen Watkinson was a film.
Very funny.
Right.
He'd also pitched that. I was already going to say it, but then when I went through the emails... You can email us these suggestions at moviesyouforgot@gmail.com, or just say nice things and query things we've said and...
Yeah.
Join the Discord as well. Which
the Discord's really been on fire in the last week. Some of the chat in there.
Mm.
We've do you know why I think that's? Because we've been talking about Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, thick with the Lord of the Rings chat. Don't let that dissuade you. I will always be there to pour scorn over such chat, and I'll be flying the flag for things like Duel, Steven Spielberg's directorial debut, and other things that get a dustier response.
Sure.
Okay, can I get you on Parasite? He's playing the card. I know I can.
I know you know you can. I just, I didn't know if we were ready for this or not. Parasite, you know? Parasite? Do you think we're ready for Parasite? Some people say it's the best film ever.
Right. And I don't understand. I want to rewatch it. I really want to rewatch it, and I've been holding off rewatching it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, sure, okay, you've got me. You've got me. You know, it is Christmas. I don't really want to watch... As we record, I know listeners are hearing this in the new year, but...
The other one I really want to do is Predator.
Okay, let's do Parasite.